inviting diverse thought leaders to explore topics designed to spark our collective imagination. Welcome to AKQA Insight.
We're all telling the same stories over and over again. Succession is King Lear, it's Shakespearean. If there is a secret, I think it is, as with everything, I think just after doing it for such a long time, I think you sort of hone the skill of spotting potential. And I think that's it, is you can see potential in things, you know how to build that potential into something special. Real change happens when at every level you have a diverse range of people from different places, different backgrounds. Only then will those stories feel absolutely authentic, I think.
Today we welcome Liz Kilgareth, former senior commissioning editor for BBC Drama, who has a proven track record for picking compelling narratives. Her BBC hits include Bodyguard, Luther, McMafia, Poldark and The Cry. And her portfolio has been internationally recognised at the BAFTAs, Emmys, Golden Globes and the National Television Awards. Liz, it's lovely to have you with us today. We find ourselves in a world which requires total isolation on one hand because of the pandemic, but also needs us all to be united on the other hand due to the insidious racism being faced across the globe. And I'm sure both will significantly influence storytelling in the future. And we'll discuss that later on today. But I'd love to start at the beginning for you and your journey into television.
Great. Hello.
Hello.
Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
I think I'd always been obsessed with television. It was a big part of my life growing up. And I studied English and American literature at university. Right. And I think whilst I was there, I really wanted to do something where I would be telling stories. And I suppose the sort of natural extension of that to me was television drama. So after I'd finished my degree, I very naively moved to London and thought I'd just get a job straight away at the BBC. And it was a rude awakening when I realised that no one was interested. And so actually, it's interesting because I was thinking about this. I didn't have any contacts at all in the industry. Right. I had no way in at all. And I didn't know that I had no way in, if that makes sense. So I just started temping in London as a secretary and just did everything I could to make one of those temp jobs be in a television company. And actually, in the end, I ended up, I remember temping for the BBC, but in their complaints department. but I was answering letters of complaint, mainly to Radio 4, interestingly. And so I thought, okay, this is it. I've got my foot in the door. This is my way in.
At least you got to hear what people didn't like about storytelling.
Yeah, I did. And so really, yeah, I just did everything I could. Actually, I landed a job with a production company, Ecos Films, they were called. And it was very early days when they just made a film called Mrs. Brown. And they were about to make a film called Charlotte Grey. And they were about to make a big TV show called Monica of the Glen. If anyone remembers that, you probably won't. And I started there as an assistant, just doing all the, you know, all the getting everyone lunch and making coffee and tea. I had no idea as to what I actually wanted to do. I knew I wanted to work in television. I thought the only way to do that was to work on set. Right. And I got the chance to go and spend some time on the Charlotte Gray set, actually assisting the director. I was really, really bad at it, though, and actually got sort of gently fired after two weeks, not from my actual job with the production company, but just as the director's assistant, which I'm sure was really, now I think about it, was probably very awkward for them at the time. And soon after that, it actually made me question everything. So I just thought, I don't know, this isn't quite what I thought it was going to be. You know, there's right. a lot of running around and getting honey for cereal and buying hangers. And I don't know, things that I weren't really what I was, it wasn't quite what I thought it was going to be. And actually then I was in the office and they were doing a big storylining meeting for Monica of the Glen, which at the time I think had about 8 writers on it. And there was one young guy at the centre of all of it as I was going in and out with my coffee and tea who was running the storyline session. And I thought, is that a job where you actually get to just sit in a room all day and talk about story and character and build a show? And so I sort of nabbed him afterwards and asked him what he did. And he said, oh, I'm a script editor. And I was like, okay, I didn't even know that they existed. Right. And then he just told me his route to how he got there, which was basically he'd spent a long time on EastEnders, he'd learned his craft, and then had sort of moved out as a script editor, and then, you know, was working on this big show. And that's when I thought, okay, that's it, I found it, which was a huge relief, actually, just to find where I was aiming.
Right. And then you went on to Casualty from there to be script editor.
I did. I actually, very naively, I followed his route, actually. And that was to be, I gave up my job in the production company and I was a freelance script reader where you read sort of the slush piles of all the film and TV companies. And basically what you're doing is you're reading everything that they haven't got time to read and just making sure they're not missing out on any gems. Right. So I did that. And then I got a job as a reader for the BBC. It took me three goes to get the job. They used to advertise every 6 months.
Right.
And it all sounds so easy now. It was full of angst at the time. and actually, once I got that in-house script reader job, I sort of was doing that for 3 months. And then once you were in there, you know, there was a lot more opportunity. And a job on Casualty came up as a script editor. And I remember, yeah. God, I realize how old I am now. Like, because I hadn't watched Casualty. I knew on the Friday I was going to have an interview on the Monday. So I took a load of VHS tapes home and just watched a whole series of Casualty over the weekend.
I loved it. The old school way of
It was proper VHS night VHS. In. And then went in on Monday and as if I'd always loved and known the show and managed to get the job. And actually that then was the start of my sort of proper career, I suppose. Yeah, so a year on Casualty, yeah. And then I worked on a lot of shows as a script editor and then became sort of moved a bit more into the development side of things as a development exec, and then worked my way up from there as a creative director and producer and exec producer, and then to commissioner, and then obviously set up my own company last year. But that all took 20 years, so it took quite a long time.
And it's been an incredible 20 years. I mean, you produced some of the BBC's most memorable and acclaimed dramas. And, you know, over those 20 years, what's that secret to producing hit after hit?
There is no secret. I wish there was, and that I had the key to it. And actually, I mean, it is worth saying that, you know, even in commissioning, you genuinely, you never, ever know how something is going to go down with the audience. You really don't. Right. I mean, sometimes you know. I mean, Bodyguard, I think we all knew that it would do well, as in it would do. Everyone right. felt confident about it. No one knew that it would catch fire in the way that it did. And sometimes things just catch fire and you just don't know. I mean, Killing Eve did the same thing, not my show, but Killing Eve did the same thing, where again, no one knew how successful that was going to be. And yet when you watch it, you think, well, of course it was, but that's actually not always the case. And actually sometimes, if I'm really honest, sometimes there were shows that we thought, oh gosh, not sure how this is going to do.
Right.
And then we'd do extremely well. if there is a secret, I think it is, as with everything, I think just after doing it for such a long time, I think you get, you sort of hone the skill of spotting potential. And I think that's it, is you can see potential in things, you know how to build that potential into something special. I think that's the thing that you learn. But everything is, as I say, everything's a risk. You never, ever get a script. I thought when I went into commissioning that you would just be sort of handed scripts that were just fantastic and ready to go. And you just choose which one you'd like to do. That never, ever happens. Everything has to go on a very long journey. And so much of it is about being able to see what it could be and try and get it there. Yeah.
And I mean, structuring stories for TV versus film requires a different skill set, right?
Yes. Yeah. It's very, very different. Yeah.
Because TV is all writer led and film is mostly director led.
Director led. Yeah. Yeah. And I think it's interesting, actually. I wouldn't even, you know, we won't be making film in my company. I think it's a very, I feel like, you know, my 20 years has been solely in television.
Yeah.
And they are quite, I mean, they of course they cross over a lot, and writers certainly cross between the two all the time. But, you know, everything I do is about thinking in terms of telling story across quite an extended time frame. So we're always thinking about 6 to 8 part series. So if you're telling a story that's 6 or 8 hours or even 10 hours long, it's a completely different way of structuring the story, and you can go much deeper. And the way you structure, certainly your way into that 6 part or 8 part drama, it's very, very different. So your pilot has to absolutely bring in your audience, hold on to them, grab them, and then want them to come back. And that's quite a different kind of structural storytelling to film. You know, there are lots of stories that come our way that we don't do because they feel like they would work as features much better than, you know, especially that's why I think horror is quite an interesting. We're always thinking about this. How do we do a big British horror series? And the reason why there are so many brilliant horror films, of course, is because you can sustain attention across 90 minutes, 2 hours. Whereas if you have to keep breaking that with episode breaks, it's much harder. So you have to think of it in a slightly different way.
Well, it's potentially why Killing Eve is successful. There's an element of horror to that sometimes.
yes, indeed.
And have you seen the art of storytelling change over your career?
I think good storytelling is always good storytelling. And I think the fundamentals of that stay the same. I mean, the truth is that we're all telling the same stories over and over again. Succession is King Lear, it's Shakespearean, it's everything is sort of the same story, but it's how you then constantly put that into a world that feels fresh and new, or tell it in a way that feels very distinctive, or you know, actually use it to explore themes that everyone, and to articulate things that affect people as of now, I think, and the human, you know, the human condition that's being articulated, it's the same, you know, across time. But what I would say is I think storytelling has got a lot faster. I think pace has changed enormously. I watched first episode of Prime Suspect the other day for something, and it still is one of the most brilliant pieces of television, but it's so slow. And actually, I say all this, actually, having obviously the big anomaly is Normal People, which I'm sure lots of people will have seen. And that is unique in that it is incredibly slow in terms of, I say slow in terms of how the story plays out, and not actually on the face of it, not an awful lot happens, but actually it has such enormous emotional scale. It feels huge at the same time. I feel that's a sort of unique piece. But aside from that, I definitely feel like the audience expects story to turn quickly.
I think we've come on to format, because I think format's definitely an audience expectations is a big discussion point.
Yeah.
Has commissioning changed over the last 10 years?
Yes, I think it has. I think inevitably, you know, when you think 10 years ago, I mean, obviously my experience being the BBC, you know, 10 years ago, the BBC, it was very different. It's a very, very different market. You know, you didn't have the big S4 players. And so I think probably in my time as a commissioner, I think commissioners were much more involved than they perhaps used to be, for better or worse. I hope that commissioning has become more diverse. I think it's had to, because, you know, because of the competition. That's, you know, that's the very good thing about there being so many broadcasters now and so many platforms, that everyone's had to sort of think, okay, how are we serving all audiences, but doing that in a way that doesn't feel generic, doing that in the way that feels quite specific according to each show.
So that leads us nicely on to new formats and audience expectations, especially in a multi-platform world that we live in today, and where people, you know, experience stuff on their mobile for 5 minutes or maybe binge for 5 hours when they're at home in front of Netflix, through to social media playing a part in stories and having multifaceted kind of stories that aren't just on the screen in front of you, but potentially in your own world in social media. So yeah, it'd be interesting to hear how those new formats and platforms have influenced kind of, you know, the production of TV and storytelling.
I think it has changed things, but I still feel that there is a huge place for a much more immersive form of storytelling, which is why I think long form will always be okay, because I just think you can go deeper, you can articulate things in a different way. And I think the way you sort of embrace that multi-platform experience is then allowing people to talk about what they're watching and share parts of what they're watching whilst they're watching it. So it does become, you know, it potentially becomes quite a distracted experience, but there's something about that where everything is sort of working together. We had a show, it was a show called 13, that again was quite early days. It was when BBC Three moved online. And we were asked to try and embrace the sort of multi-platform experience and sort of come up with another narrative that would run alongside the linear show. And I feel embarrassed to say this now because it feels, so obvious. But then, which was about 5 years ago, I couldn't quite get my head around what that was. I was like, well, so what is it? Is it a game that people play alongside the actual show? Or is it? And actually, of course, it wasn't that at all. We created a character who was of the world but sat outside the show, who was commenting on what was going on, but was also part of the community as well. So she became someone who could speak directly to viewers, but she was fictional. She had a special sort of insight. And so it allowed people to start talking. And because it was, a sort of twisty, turny thriller, it allowed people to put forward their thoughts on what they think, who they thought had done it and what was going on and all that kind of stuff. So that was quite a sort of crude example.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because you can use those platforms so the audience can form deeper connections and more intimate connections, yes, potentially with the characters. And find out stuff that they might not find out in the linear series. And I think that's the beauty of the multi-platform experience, isn't it? Is that you can tell other stories that help to bring people into the program and the story.
I mean, I worried for a while that I watched my own children, you know, watching things on their phone and YouTube and very short form pieces. You sort of wonder whether anyone would want to sit down and watch anything beyond sort of 10, 15 minutes, but people do, of course they do. It's a different kind of experience, a different type kind of storytelling. I think there's a reason why 30 to 40 minutes, 45 minutes on Netflix does very well though. I do think the 60 minute sort of terrestrial hour does feel like quite a long time now with the way storytelling's going.
There must be some interesting research around attention spans and how that's changing. Yeah. And because, like you say, 45 minutes seems enough. But then if you're really interested in a series, 60 minutes doesn't seem long enough. And then you end up binging and watching three episodes at once.
Yes, exactly. And if you're building an episode one for a BBC show, especially a BBC One show, you've got 7 days between that, the audience coming from that first episode to the second episode. So you have to really make sure that it feels big enough and hooky enough for that person to come back. Whereas with Netflix or with the S-Words, you know that it's going to be very easy for people to, I think it's a slightly different relationship where people go, well, I'll just keep going, you know, because it's there and you can.
Yeah.
It's
interesting.
There is a difference. Yeah.
It's the same with cinema as well, with films being released to cinema and then people having to wait 3 to 6 months before they can then get it on Netflix.
Yes.
And
yes.
I guess people's minds are, well, why do I have to wait in a world of immediacy?
Yes.
What's the reason?
When I was at the BBC, what started to happen is happening all the time now. It's become very, there's been a massive shift in the last few years where in terms of reporting figures and how well something's done. So obviously that was always done on overnights and still is to a certain extent, but it's such a small part of the story because actually McMathieu is a really good example of this because if you look at the overnights for that show, it looked like they went down quite considerably across the series in a way that at the time, I remember it was awful. It was sort of like, oh God, what's happened? You know, and I know, it was a very particular kind of show, but actually though, what was happening was people were waiting and there was a lot of word of mouth going on. And actually it was people were waiting to binge it on, they wanted the whole thing to play out and then watch the whole thing on iPlayer. Actually the final figures were huge, but that was quite a long time. You know, it had quite a long sort of tail on it, if that makes sense. So, and people will hear about shows and they'll come to them in episode 3 and suddenly you'll get a big spike in people watching.
Right. So like the early adopters.
Yeah. So you've got maybe episodes 1 or 2 will do okay. And then suddenly episode 3, there'll be huge overnights because word of mouth has sort of told people about something. They've gone and caught up on iPlayer and watched 1 and 2, ready to watch episode 3 with everybody else. So it's really interesting.
Yeah. And we kind of touched upon it in commissioning, but obviously the market's been flooded with lots of new entrants, Netflix, Amazon, Amazon Prime, Netflix Original, Disney Plus, most recently Apple TV, all producing their own content and producing brilliant content as well. What's that meant for commissioning and production?
Well, from a commissioning perspective, initially, huge competition, lots of money. You know, they have a lot of money, able to pay talent a lot of money, a lot more than the BBC could pay initially. I'll just talk very quickly from a commissioning perspective. It was really interesting because there was a little bit of when Netflix sort of first came on the scene and was sort of, paying lots of money and it was very exciting and all that, it did really feel that everyone was sort of losing talent perhaps. To SVODs, but actually it's more than money. You want your show to be made in the right way, and also you want your show to be seen by as many people as possible. And I still think if you can get that, if you can get that big hit on terrestrial television, you're reaching 7-8 million people. Bodyguard obviously was like 17 million people. It's insane. And also it just feels it's a really big moment that brings everyone together. And actually what had happened and is still happening is there's a lot of co-production that happens. So the big SVODs are still co-producing with the terrestrials, a lot with the BBC. And yes, they are definitely now moving into wanting to solely commission. So you've got your Netflix Originals, your Amazon Originals, because they want to hold on to everything. But that's a bit more gradual than you'd think. It's quite interesting. Still co-production happening. I think Normal People was picked up by Hulu, and HBO do a lot of co-production with the BBC. So it is interesting. But competition, big competition for commissioners. As a producer and as a production company, it's brilliant. Because it's great on the other side. It's great because you have all these buyers potentially. I say that, it's not quite as... It's not quite as straightforward as that, because there are also loads of producers and lots of production companies. So with the rise of more buyers, there are now also more sellers. Obviously, there's more production companies. Yeah. So it's incredibly competitive.
That brings us neatly on to kind of the effect of COVID on both production and audience habits. I guess over the last few months, I've seen a surge in short form content, even on terrestrial TV, and some dramas being filmed in short form. But also, you know, production's been halted, and we're seeing reruns on television as well, even to the point where there's small warning stickers in the top right hand corner saying this is a rerun, do not phone in. Have you seen the effect of COVID-19?
I think the sort of immediate effect, of course, you say, is that production had to be stood down. So the immediate effect is obviously going to be shows that haven't been finished. Right. And so there will be holes in schedules. And I imagine that schedules are going to look very different for the rest of the year. So I think for the big broadcasters, obviously it's a huge challenge, and it's sort of thinking about what have they got and moving everything around. So there's that in the first instance. Obviously, that's different for the SVODs because they don't have the same schedule issues. But for them, I think, and for everybody, it's about acquiring content. So I think if you have a show, as you were saying in terms of reruns, if you have a show that did well a few years ago, I imagine it's been great because I imagine lots of, I think probably back catalogues have been being, you know, sort of rebought and will be being put on. And I think there'll be lots of acquisitions. But I think in terms of moving forward, and actually there's lots of conversation about this at the moment in terms of how the production community moves forward, it's going to be about how we get back to filming as quickly as possible, but obviously as safely as possible, but it's going to be more expensive. So because it's going to be slower and it's going to have lots of extra conditions and things around that. And I think there's insurance, you know, it's all kinds of things, I think, you know. Production's difficult and expensive at the best of times. You know, it's a lot of people involved, so it's going to be even more so now. That's all to be worked out. We were very fortunate in that we weren't filming when it happened. I think for anyone who had to shut down halfway through, I imagine that's difficult because you've got high-end talent who I don't quite know how that works, to be honest, in terms of if they were signed to do something else in January of next year, and that's when you're hoping to stand your show back up again. I'm not quite like the knock-on, the domino effect of it is hard to sort of work out. And I imagine for agents, it's probably an interesting time.
You've seen it's forced a lot of people, though, hasn't it, to really think about, especially live TV, where you've seen people, you know, broadcasting the weather from their front rooms or newsreaders continuing their show from their outside space at home.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it's definitely forced a lot of people to think quickly about how they can still continue to air programming.
Yes. And it is, it's amazing how people sort of pivot and you know, adjust to things. It really is. I mean, certainly in terms of us, in terms of our drama, we've put heat under our slightly shorter form shows, our four-part pieces that are a bit more contained, and are, you know, we've got a lot of shows that aren't UK based, but all those that are UK based and are a bit more contained, of course, we're fast tracking those, because that's the reality. You've got to be pragmatic about it. They're the things that probably will be able to shoot first and more quickly. And you sort of think, you know, broadcasters will need those pieces to start, you know, filling their schedule. So it's going to be really interesting, but there's a lot of discussion around it, as I'm sure there is in every industry.
Yeah. And so something we talked about earlier, a big part of storytelling is talent. And I know it's something that you've been very good at spotting in the past, but everything from not just actors and things like that, but from writers as well. So how do you find emerging talent?
We are just, it's a really, really big part of, it always has been actually, as you say, it's something I'm really passionate about. And we as a company just work very hard to make sure that we're across all the various places where emerging talent might be coming through. So obviously that's theatre, that's new writer schemes. The BBC run a brilliant writer scheme, the NFTS, there's a big academy, you know, all of those. So we are involved in all of those schemes and we work with all the writers on those schemes. And obviously that's because we should be doing that. But obviously, of course, we're absolutely trying to spot the people that we'd like to then develop further. And we speak to agents, We read. I mean, last year we worked out, we met just under 200 writers, I think, in our first year. and actually out of that, I think we have a slate of about 25 projects. So, but it's so much of it is about building relationships. And even if we don't have a project right now with someone, it's constant conversation, constant thinking, trying to find the right thing. And especially with newer writers, it's about making sure that we build an idea of theirs, or, you know, or we work with them on an idea that we know, we genuinely know, if we get it right, it could get picked up. I mean, we will always have read something or watched a short or seen a play or whatever. We would only meet people, I think, where you can just see that however raw something is, or however structurally maybe sort of, I don't know, a bit all over the place or whatever, I think if you connect with it, and if you know that those writers who are able to articulate emotion and sort of connect with the audience on some level, that's the magic. That's the magic that you're looking for, because you can't teach that, and that just is there. And then, but in terms of then working on a sort of more practical, structural, you know, creating a television show sort of level, that's fine. So you're looking for that, and you're looking for someone, obviously, who's completely passionate about what they're doing, has a really, 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 really clearly knows what they want to say. And the brilliant thing now is when you meet younger writers, they're about 5 years ahead anyway, because everyone watches so much television. So you're already talking on a level that's, you know, the bar is already high. You know, writers, I think, know that they need to create things that feel new and distinctive.
Right.
So it's exciting. It's an exciting time. There's lots of really brilliant people out there.
Yeah. And as we talk about kind of that character development and those story narratives, are audiences attracted to the same kind of stories and subjects they were, you know, 10 years ago? Or has that kind of changed? As you said, you know, younger writers are 5 years ahead of us and more connected. So has that changed the way that, you know, audiences are attracted to stories?
I think audiences want to be surprised. And they want to go, oh, I know you want me to think that. And I know you want me to think that, but I really hope you're going to surprise me. And it's not going to be that. So there's this really sort of fun relationship I think you have with the audience, where they put themselves in your hands and they go, right, now surprise me. But at the same time, I think the sort of familiarity of, I mean, that's why crime genre does so well, because there is a familiarity to it, you know, and you sort of, or a mystery or a whodunit, you know what the contract is, you know, with between the producer and the audience, I think. And there's something really enjoyable about that. So actually, I would say, I think the audience expects the same, as in they want to connect with their characters. And that's the most important thing. And what is that emotional story at the centre? And what is that thing that actually the writer is exploring across the piece? You know, whether that's grief or love or friendship or family with, you know, back to Succession. And it's those relatable universal emotional truths that haven't changed at all. I think everyone comes expecting that. But then, you know, how you tell that story and how you raise the stakes on that emotional through line is the thing, I think, that the audience expects you to be original and distinctive, and surprising. I think anything that feels generic or cynical, I just think, I don't know. I think the audience can spot it a mile off.
Yeah. It must be tough in a connected world where we're more aware of what's happening around us. I'm sure like you say, a lot of audiences have become desensitized to generic things, and expectations are much higher. I think, you know, one thing I'd love to talk about today, and it's very true for the world that we live in today, is, you know, we know that it's through stories and not statistics that people make sense of the world. And there's been a massive amount of research recently that shows negative stereotypes of Black people and minorities in the news, media and entertainment, that's responsible for a lot of the racism that exists today. And I'd love to kind of hear your point of view on how kind of the media in these industries can present a different narrative.
It's not just on screen, it's behind the screen as well. I think real change happens when at every level you have a diverse range of people from different places, different backgrounds. Only then will those stories feel absolutely authentic, I think. You've got to have diversity at the top in terms of senior management and in terms of the people making decisions. But that takes a while, and that means that you've got to be bringing people through the system. And I think that's when real change can happen. I mean, it's...
And that's what makes great work, is the different viewpoints, people's different experiences, people's different cultures is what makes great work.
It really does. And it also, it makes work that feels new and original and distinctive, because everyone has a different take.
And what would your tips be for things we should be watching that are out at the moment?
Normal People, I thought, was one of the most beautiful things I'd seen. It's so unique, though, that show. But I just think as a way to make a show in every sort of way, it's so beautifully, beautifully done. Very different, actually, to the sort of pieces we're developing. As I say, you know, we're much more in the... we have a snowboarding horror, for example, which is nothing like as grounded and stylish as Normal People. But no, I do think Normal People is a sort of rather beautiful piece to watch. It's quite painful to watch as well, I think. But I think it takes you back to a certain place, however old you are. I think you can connect with it. There's quite a few Hulu shows coming through at the moment over here that are quite interesting to watch, actually. And there's obviously the new Reese Witherspoon, Little Fires Everywhere. And there's a Patricia Arquette show called The Act, which is very dark, but is, I don't know, it's rather a brilliant watch. And the Michaela Cole show on BBC is extraordinary. Everyone should watch that. It's kind of amazing. That would be my big recommendation, actually.
Cole show is called, the Michaela Cole Show?
The Michaela Cole Show is I May Destroy You.
We will have to get the audience to watch that. Thank you very much for joining us today. It's been an amazing conversation, especially given where we find ourselves in the world today, both in your industry, but also in the narratives that need to be told, and also the habits that our audience have and that are changing, you know, over time quite quickly. So thank you very much for joining us on AKQA Insight. I hope when we get the chance to bring people back together again at physical events, we can maybe host one of your pilots or one of your first episodes in person for an AKQA Insight, and invite all of our clients and all of the friends of AKQA to come and watch it with us as well. But thank you very much for joining us, Liz. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you, Sam. Thanks.
Thanks for listening, and please join us for the next episode of AKQA Insight.